Gordy and Mike are back with another edition of After the Buzzer from the Man Cave. Gordy, how you holding up?
Outstanding. And yourself?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. We have a guest that is a basketball guy and a writing guy. So he's absurdly suited to this show.
Indeed.
So it's weird that we haven't had him on before, but we're grateful to have him now. He is Paul Shirley, a 9-year professional basketball player, including 18 NBA games. That's two a year. That's load management, my friend. That's what we call that. And he's also the author of 5 books and 2 novels, the latest of which is called David, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. And we're also going to talk about the fact that Paul once said that rooting for the San Antonio Spurs is like rooting for cancer. Paul, welcome to After the Buzzer.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm pleased to be the center of the Venn diagram.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's what I should have said. And I forgot to mention the Peloton for productivity
and,
too.
And we should be clear that it wasn't 18 games over 9 years. It was 18 games over 3 years.
Yeah,
but also played in Greece, Spain, Russia, and China. So
I was doing some.
There were mitigating circumstances.
Indeed.
Paul, I didn't get all the way through the book, but I got part of it, not because I gave up on it, because just time constraints. A couple of things that I thought you did really well that I think are hard to do, and that's that basic thing of storytelling readability that is a little different, I think, for novels than nonfiction. And the other thing is that I thought you wrote really well about women and with women characters.
Yeah,
so let's take the first one of those. And you know, how conscious are you of the difference between fiction and nonfiction and trying to achieve that readability where the reader just wants to get to the next thing?
Well, first, thank you. That's I think my main goal with fiction is to make sure that somebody can get to the end of the book. Which
right.
Obviously, I haven't succeeded completely with you, but we'll get you there. I find a lot of quote literary fiction to be insufferable because there's an assumption that the reader should be grateful to the writer for writing the book almost.
Yeah.
And I think that there's this responsibility we all have in all forms of storytelling to make sure that first we get the person to the end of the story and that then along the way hopefully we can tell them something. But at the worst, you know, you want to keep that person, that fan in the seat for the whole game.
Right.
And so I, like, it is obviously a bit odd that a guy who played professional basketball now sometimes writes fiction. But I have been at this a while, and I find that in fiction, sometimes I can tell more truth than in nonfiction, just because
sure.
In fiction, you're allowed to make up characters that might say something that you want to say but can't say, or that you would maybe regret later, or whatever that situation is. So I have actually poured a lot of thought into how to write fiction, and
yeah.
You know, of course, read a fair bit about it, but most of it comes from the trial and error of writing bad fiction and then eventually getting to at least tolerable fiction.
And now let's talk about the second thing, which is writing about women and putting yourself in the person of a female character, which I find in the little bit of fiction writing that I've done to be really difficult.
Well, so I would say that sometimes women are able to analyze men more accurately because they're on the outside and they're able to show us things about ourselves that we don't see. I find that to be true with relationships I'm in or with female friends I have. And I think that the same can be true in the opposite, right? Like in the time that we live in, which is the online discourse is pretty feminized, I think that it could be valuable to have an outside voice or an outside look at like what we think women are like. And in some ways, because each gender is different than the other, we sometimes have a hard time describing ourselves. I think that's true of all people. Like, people are generally bad at self-description. Mm-hmm. And so I have found that in having to describe a female character, because I am not a woman, I can't speak to what that world is like, I also am then needing to describe it more fully for the reader. I have found that in writing, the further something is away from my experience, the better I can write about it, because I have to describe it for myself first, and then therefore the reader along the way. Sometimes when if I try to create a character that's too close to me, then my instinct is like, well, you know, just like me. And then the reader is, of course, does not know. if I were describing, I don't know, I don't write like fantasy or anything like that, but if I were describing some wizard or world that I had to build, I think I would actually do a better job of describing it, because I would have to also describe it for myself.
Interesting. Why music? Why did you want to do music?
Well, so I wrote about music for ESPN for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And I got to know that world really well. Mm-hmm. My job was just interviewing bands and going to shows. And it is a world that is fun to read about, I think. Mm-hmm. I read a lot. I don't read as much now because I'm sort of bored with it. But I think a lot of, quote, literary fiction is boring, in part because the worlds they choose are often boring. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to tell a story, I would rather have you get excited about reading. Like, oh, shit, yeah, I want to read about a rock band. That sounds kind of fun. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, I want to read about a grad student.
So what was the most challenging part of this project, and what was the most fulfilling part of it?
Challenging to me is the fear that it's going to unravel at any time. I think with fiction, because you're creating the world out of thin air,
right,
there is a real tenuousness.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, like, with nonfiction, if I'm telling a story that I've seen or that has happened to me, I can always come back to, like, well, I don't know, man, that's just how it happened, right? With fiction, there's this feeling that you might, like, end up down some dead end that, like, just leads nowhere or doesn't have any kind of a satisfactory conclusion. So I think there's this anxiety that just is kind of inevitable along the way, where you're like, I don't know where these characters are going. You know, like, it sounds like you guys know this world a little bit. And smart writers talk about how if you create characters that are fully thought out and fleshed out, they will start to make decisions on their own, which I think is the most wondrous thing about writing fiction, where you truly don't know what's going to happen when you sit down to write, and then the characters kind of drive the story. But with that said, that's terrifying because you are giving up control. and so I think that's part of what I like or I love about writing fiction, is that it is so uncontrollable and scary. Mm-hmm. And so then if you're able to pull off a coherent novel, it's magical. And so I think that's the fulfilling part, is like knowing that I had to let go of control and that I was able to do that and that it all worked out in the end.
That's cool. That's an interesting way to look at it. I was reading a magazine interview with a writer today who had written a bestseller, and now I forget her name, but she was talking about how she wrote this best-selling novel while having a full-time job and being the mother of a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. And she was talking about her process and how she literally would put the kids in the bathtub, get a glass of wine for herself, sit on the toilet with the seat down, and write for 45 minutes in the evening, you know, with her laptop on her lap. Anyway, my point is, I think people are invariably interested in the process, the writer's process, even if Gordy and I understand that it's completely individual and idiosyncratic and might not be of any use to us. So, sorry for the laborious question here, but what is your process, the physical process of how you work?
Well, first of all, I think the good news is that it's actually not that idiosyncratic, right? It turns out that the artists we love, there's this book by this guy, Mason Curry, that I really like, where he kind of analyzes people throughout history and their processes, their systems, their habits. And it basically always comes down to regularity and consistency and some degree of perseverance. So, you know, that process of having 45 minutes really rings true for me. I will try to sum this up because it's, you know, something that I am passionate about. That's why I now run a company specifically around this. This morning, so I'm finishing right now the rough draft of a novel that will be the book after my next book, right? Assuming that it all comes together. I hit the 96,000 word mark this morning. That book I started January 10th, I think. And right now the rule is I have to write 1,000 words in the morning before I turn on my phone, probably at a coffee shop. Usually that takes me around 40 to 45 minutes. I have over time gotten a little faster. It used to be that 1,000 words would take me an hour and 15 minutes, but now, because sort of similar to that woman you described, I'm running effectively like two different businesses, and I just don't have time. But in a lot of ways, that's good. That forces me to write quickly. It forces me to be reactive instead of perseverating over what might happen. I will put this particular rough draft away and work on something else for 3 months, and then for 3 months after that, I will work on yet something else. And then come next winter, I might revisit this book and do 3 months of editing it. In the editing process, it's similar. I will allow myself 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, just to, kind of depending on the day. That's first thing. That's while I'm still in something of a dreamlike state after waking up, before I've like let the world in on the day. And honestly, it often feels really self-indulgent because I have investors in this company that I run. I have employees, and sometimes there's this temptation to think like, oh, I should start working. But there's something about writing that is very similar to, for me, working out, where I'm a better person once I've written for the day. I think we all need something like that, that is a creative outlet, that's a long project that we have some control over, even though I just talked about how you don't have much control over a novel. But it allows me to feel like I have accomplished something to start my day, and that is basically invaluable at this point when there's so many other things that are out of my control. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, sure, it makes sense. I mean, the part that's idiosyncratic is you go to a coffee shop. Some people, that's the last place they go. You know, that kind of thing. That's the part that's very individual.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I honestly just, I can barely work at home now because it's not, like, my self-discipline is, as you can imagine, good, but I still just feel this nagging temptation to do something else. And there's something about the energy and peer pressure of being in a coffee shop where I think, well, I wouldn't really love it if everybody just saw me out here on Facebook all day long. So that vanity, I guess, works in my favor, and I use it to get stuff done. I would say that one of the things that I think is important about these questions of process is that it doesn't have to be so hard. So, you know, before the show, we were talking about how I used to run a space in LA for writers. I would get kind of actively annoyed when occasionally a writer would come in and say, I try to write for 6 hours a day, and I wanted to like jump up and say, okay, well, where are the three novels you should have finished this year that were really true? Because most people are full of shit when they talk about how much they work. Much rather demystify it for somebody and say, look, if you have 20 minutes at the start of your day, you could write a novel in 6 months, in 20 minutes out of whack. If you do it 6 days a week and you stay truly diligent about your start time, your stop time. But sometimes people don't want to hear that too. They want to think that there's some like magic or mystery behind it. And And I'm here to tell you, there isn't. It's just a matter of the regularity and diligence about it.
Well, if you think about it, by the time people get to be as old as we are, they have spent, it's been a long, long time since they spent a lot of time really being imaginatively creative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and it that that's it, it's almost like they've forgotten when they were a little kid and they did just make stuff up for the hell of it. You know, that I think that's a unique that's piece good. Of
that's good.
What you're doing, you know, and what all novelists try to do.
Yeah, I think it's unique in that I happen to write fiction. I think everybody has that gear. I just bought the Rick Rubin book, and I really like the first page where he talks about how everyone's a creative. We like to, or sometimes it's tempting to put people in buckets and say like, well, that person's artistic, I'm not, or that person's
yeah,
creative, I'm
right.
Not. I just don't think that's really true. I mean, if you have an IQ over 90, you're probably chomping at the bit to create something. And for some of us, it means writing. And for some of us, it's cooking. And for some of us, it's starting businesses. And for some of us, it's many of those things. But you're right that sometimes when people are rusty, they forget that it is a childlike act, and that it also feels really good. You guys may remember this or know this, but I moved to LA to make a TV show the first time I moved to LA.
Mm-hmm.
That was based on my first book. And when we signed the deal to get to write the pilot, which was a very cool thing to happen, the studio said, well, there's one condition, and that is that you have to act, or you have to learn how to act, Paul, in case we can't find someone to play the lead. And I was at first reluctant because I had never wanted to be the guy who like pitched a show where he was also the lead actor in it. But I went along with it and I got an acting coach. The studio hired this amazing woman to teach me how to act. And one of our first jobs was stripping away all of my insecurities about being childlike. Like that so much of acting was just trying to get yourself into a childlike state where you could pretend, which is something that as adults we don't often do. And I think the point of this is that that's universally true, whether it's acting or writing or creating a pitch deck or working on a marketing campaign. It's always this vulnerable space that is also not dissimilar to sports, right? Like to play a sport at a high level, you kind of have to suspend disbelief and go out there and just say, I think I can hit this baseball over the fence. Now, I might be wrong, but it has to start with a real yes and attitude.
Yeah. So the TV thing, that was, if I'm not mistaken, that was going to be called The 12th Man, and it was based on your book, Can I Keep My Jersey, correct?
Yes, good memory.
Mm-hmm. So I would watch that. I mean, maybe they decided that other people, there weren't enough people like me that would watch it, but I'd watch that because I love that book.
It could have been good. Mm-hmm. The pilot is not very good. It's tough. What it turns out is that people don't generally like their sports to be made fun of. Mm-hmm. And now that we're so used to seeing sports on TV, and this was true even, this was whatever, 16 years ago,
mm-hmm.
It still doesn't look like sports actually looks. Mm-hmm. And that's tough.
That's the hardest really part of those things, I think.
Yeah.
Hey, I also wanted to ask you about your book, David, from the standpoint, there's a reference to one of my favorite movies within it, Almost Famous, and there's actually a blogger who's embedded with the band. Was that at all an inspiration for this on any level?
I love that movie also. I don't know that I consciously was inspired, but I'm sure that unconsciously I was inspired by that idea of having a neophyte along for the ride. Like, that's obviously a literary mechanism, right? Like, if the band has to explain it to him, then they're sort of explaining it to the reader also. I think I also just liked that idea that like there would be someone hopeful and optimistic along for the ride,
mm-hmm.
with a band that starts out kind of a little jaded or suspicious or reluctant, and that his enthusiasm also helps guide them, which I think is really true and almost famous as well.
Yeah, for sure. It's a lovely movie. It really is. My favorite scene in that movie, among many, is still the one on the bus where they start singing Tiny Dancer. I mean, that just kind of warms the heart. Oh, yeah. I think, you know.
That and when Philip Seymour Hoffman answers the phone.
Yes.
Lester Bangs.
Yes.
He's like, I can't believe you're home. He's like, I'm always home. I'm uncool.
Yeah, because I'm like you. I'm uncool. Yeah. Or when Philip Seymour Hoffman says to the kid, well, you'll meet them all on their long journey to the middle. That's my favorite line in the whole movie.
There you go. There you go.
Paul, why was rooting for the Spurs like rooting for cancer? I mean, I think I have a rough idea, but I want to hear you defend this position.
I feel like back then they were Borg-like in their dominance. And at the time, I didn't appreciate systematic thinking as much as I do now. So I probably would take the exact opposite perspective at this point. I think that might have been in a piece that I did with Neil Pollack, the writer, where we were talking basketball. Funnily enough, I was just trading notes with Neil Pollack today, so everything comes back.
I feel like now
rooting for the Spurs is like rooting for flesh wounds or something. It's a very minor inconvenience.
That's very true.
Yeah, a whole different animal right now. And the other thing is, and this is just an opinion, it's not like you have to explain it or anything, but writing in your musical criticism, writing that the Beatles were overrated, which a lot of people would consider to be blasphemous.
Right.
I don't know.
If you think about it, it's almost impossible that that's not true. Because they're the most highly rated band of all time, It's likely that they are overrated.
Yeah.
That was, I got a lot of hate mail about that.
Oh, I bet.
And I was like, Jesus, guys, like, just don't read it, the piece. Or, like, I don't know, if you're that insecure about it, maybe the Beatles aren't so good.
Paul, you've made a lot of, maybe left turns is the wrong way to put it, but in your 45 years, you grew up in Kansas, in Meriden, am I pronouncing that right?
Yep.
It's population 784. You played at Iowa State, you got your degree in mechanical engineering, and now you've gone on this whole new path. How do you explain all that? What is it about you that makes you want to take these different courses?
Well, first, it's kind of you to spelunk my past and know those things about me. I will say that in the midst of it, I often forget how many things have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say many things, I say that fondly, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's been a super fulfilling and interesting life. But with that said, I'm still often paralyzed with the fear that I won't accomplish the next thing. So it's nice to occasionally get to look back and realize, like, oh yeah, I was scared back then too. And
yeah, right. That's right.
I will keep probably doing okay.
Uh-huh.
I think so. My parents did a good job of inculcating in us. I have three younger brothers. Mm-hmm. The idea that we could sort of go anywhere, do anything. You may or may not be familiar with my brother Matt, who is a Instagram famous chart maker.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Really great charts. Has his own book that came out 2 years ago. Now does infographics for companies and but is still really true to his own origins around just making funny charts. And so I know that that job didn't exist even 15 years ago. So it's a credit to our parents that they allowed us to be imaginative, that we got to, horror of horrors, play outside and be by ourselves and dream big when we were young.
Mm-hmm.
And I am, again, just grateful that you would think that of me, because it means that I'm putting into practice what I value, which is new experiences, meeting new people. There have been a lot of flights of fancy along the way. And it's, I think when I'm on my deathbed, whether that's 2 years from now or 50 years from now, I will be able to look back and say I threw it all at the wall, you know.
That's
and
nice.
Not all of it stuck, but but I tried it all. And that's, you know, it's, that's why it's an honor to get to talk about fiction, right? Like, who cares that this guy who used to play in the NBA writes fiction now? But with that said, the same characteristics that allowed me to figure out how to make my way in professional sports are the same ones that I have kind of figured out when it comes to writing, which is you try, you fail, you try, you fail a little less each time, and then eventually you get there. There's a Samuel Beckett quote we love at the process that's along those exact lines, and the sort of conclusionary piece is like, ever failed, ever better, right? Like, you just keep failing, and but that's the power of like iteration.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to something you mentioned earlier about how you make sure you don't get on your phone first thing every day, like so many of us go the other way, including myself. And you've tweeted about this too, just about, you know, just the issues with technology and how it is so pervasive in our lives now. I mean, a lot of people have talked lately, especially about just AI and what it might do to us or what might be done with it. What are your views on that, and what, you know, where that might be heading?
I think this actually goes back to my parents too. My dad did his PhD in child psychology and wrote his thesis about the effects of television on children. This was in 1974. So I think we were raised in a household that was suspicious of kind of mass entertainment, and I think we really blossomed and bloomed because of it. You know, I mentioned one brother who does what he does. I have another brother who's an infectious disease doctor.
Wow.
And another brother who is an organic farmer of all things. And I think that what we were allowed was time to find our own way, right? One of the real issues with information, there are all kinds of statistics, and one that stands out is that from 1985 to, I think it's 2015, our consumption of information increased fivefold, right? So 500%. And when all that information is coming in at you, it makes it really difficult to sit and to be bored and to synthesize and think about things that you would like to do with your life or your business, whatever it might be. My friend Megan Daum, who's a writer that I love, wrote a piece once about the power of, in her younger days, being bored, of just like, you know, she's a little older than I am, but same kind of mentality of how much she loved being in New York City with a cigarette next to her window, just sort of staring out the window. So I think that that is related to what we're talking about, that it's not only that we miss out on innovation and creativity if we don't allow ourselves that time and space to do so, but that we're also not very happy. Like, if all of this stuff were making people happier, I think I would shut up about it. But all I see is people who are disconnected, who are, like, slowly getting sadder and sadder all the time.
That's true.
And I think that, I mean, I'm prone to it, too. Like, I will find myself on Instagram at night, like, what am I doing? There's so many things I could be doing with this time. I've had to, like you mentioned, I am really militant about turning off my phone when I go to bed so that I can read and ease into the night, not turning it on in the morning. I don't have email on my phone. I now have not only a record player, but also a CD player in my living room.
Wow.
just so that I can consume music in a like discreet album-based way, because that makes me enjoy it more, right? Then I'm like, I'm going to put on, this afternoon, I put on Nine Inch Nails live album. And I'm like, you know what? I know that this is only going to play through once. Now, technically, I guess I could hit the repeat button or whatever. But, like, there's something about knowing that it's finite that makes us enjoy it.
Interesting. I like that. Do you have an 8-track player yet or not?
I should get a cassette player.
Right.
To really bridge the gap.
Paul's not as old as we are.
That's right.
What do you think of the NBA, the current iteration of the NBA, Paul?
I don't watch it, but that's not necessarily a commentary on the NBA. It's more a commentary of that circuit in my life is completely blown out.
Yeah, right.
It's just like, it just isn't fun to watch. I watch a lot more baseball. I can tell you that my Kansas City Royals lost to Baltimore Orioles today. but I couldn't tell you. Actually, I had a conversation yesterday about the playoffs with somebody who filled me in on who is in the playoffs. So I could actually tell you who's in the playoffs, but that's kind of rare. I think the NBA is a little bit broken as a sport, not necessarily through any overt action of theirs, but it seems like all the teams kind of play the same, and so that therefore it's sort of dull, and there doesn't seem to be the same stakes that the NFL has with a lot fewer games. It seems like you could get away with that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, but now it just really feels like, to me anyway, if it's a random night in January, like, why would I go watch some NBA game? There's just so many options. What do you guys think about it?
Well, I have been writing for about 40 years now that if I was king of the world, the first thing I would do is cut the NBA regular season in half. And I think that would largely solve what you just said. And in the long haul, would make money for the for the business.
Yeah.
So I hear you. Yeah.
Well, I think also if you think about why college basketball is so popular, one of the reasons is the immediacy of the NCAA tournament, which is a flawed mechanism for choosing the best team.
Yeah, for
right?
sure.
Like
for sure,
you're not going to get the best team to win, but there's just this urgency to it that I just can't see in the NBA. Even baseball, like there's something about those high leverage moments in baseball that is also true in the NFL playoffs where, you know, if you don't tune in, it might be over. The NBA playoffs feel like such a war of attrition. And like you're saying, I think it is, in the short term, they can't really see the proverbial forest for the proverbial trees. They're like, well, we're making a lot of money right now. It just, like you're saying, it feels short-sighted to me.
Yeah.
Well, here's the interesting thing, Paul. You know, you mentioned how just about every team plays the same way, you know, four out, one in, and shoot a lot of threes. But you kind of played for a team that was the antecedent to all this because you were with the Suns in the Steve Nash era. I mean, could you have ever pictured that this would happen?
Right. I was part of the problem.
clearly you were.
Yeah, I'm willing to blame you, Paul.
I think that's where, probably to fix the NBA and college basketball, they will have to take away the three-point line. They have basically broken the game because of analytics. And that's fine. That happens with all games, I guess. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't feel like there's a personality. Like, if you are watching football, there's a reality to the Pittsburgh Steelers have a personality, even though that personality might be 30 years old. There's something, I think there's just something to that. That, like, what personality, I don't know what personality the Utah Jazz have, whatever.
Paul, you alluded to a couple of writing projects that you're in the middle of or planning. What's next? What are the next couple going to be?
Kind of you to ask. The one I'm working on, the one whose second draft is done, is called You're Going to Die, and it's nonfiction aimed right now at, like, youngish men. I think because of the internet age, people lack urgency because it's easy to narcissistically think that they're going to live forever. Mm. So this is a bit of, like, hey, here's some things I've learned about, like, how to embrace life and get the most out of it. Then the novel is, I don't know. I mean, David, I've been talking about this a little bit at Book Launch Things, I started that book in, I think, October of 2018, so 4.5 years ago. Mm. So, like, this novel that I'm finishing the rough draft of, I'm, like, vaguely afraid that it'll never see the light of day. It's about a group of teachers who comes upon the old Apple IIe game, the Oregon Trail, on the University of School.
Oh, to, like, I've heard of that.
They have to, like, clean it up. And then as soon as they turn the computer on, they're transported back to 1847 and have to complete the actual Oregon Trail in order to...
I love it. I love that. I love that.
Nice.
Hey, Paul, this is speaking of left turns, this is left turn. I remember when we spoke a couple of years ago, you mentioned two anecdotes from your pro sports days. The first one was when you were admitted to the VIP area at an MC Hammer party because they thought you were Matt Leinart. And the other one, which I still cringe about, was when you drew a charge from Austin Crozier and you thought you were going to die on the flight home when you were with the Bulls at the time, I think, weren't you?
That's true. Yeah.
Oh my God! So what was?
I mean, I didn't just think I was about to die. I was, like, pretty close.
And then that was. Well, tell the story, because it's sort of how you met Scottie Pippen.
Yeah. Well, it is that I was on a 10-day contract with the Bulls after working my way up to the bigs, as it were, from the ABA's Kansas City Knights. And the Bulls were very bad. That was they were second to worst in the Eastern Conference, I think. So my main job was to prove to the Tyson Chandlers and Eddie Currys of the world that there was a way to play hard. So I feel like I really internalized that identity. And so while we were in Indianapolis playing against the Pacers, even though we were down big, I sort of made a point to rotate across the lane and try to take a charge against Austin Crozier with 5 minutes left to go in the game, us down 30, which in retrospect was really dumb. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, he accidentally put his knee into my side, and my kidney and spleen hit my backbone and exploded, and I started bleeding internally, which I did not know at the time. And so then they put me on the airplane with the rest of the team back to Chicago, not knowing that I was, like, leaking blood into my retroperitoneal cavity, and that was starting to hurt. So while we were bumping down the runway, I could tell something was wrong, and they had made a little bed for me in this, like, cabin area because they knew something was wrong too. And it hurt enough that I was kind of starting to hyperventilate, scream and cry. And so I had to turn to Scottie Pippen, who was sitting in the seat up yonder. Mm-hmm. He had come back to retire with the Bulls, was not actually playing. Mm-hmm. And said, "Scottie, can you go get help?" And so Scottie Pippen sauntered back and got the trainer, and then thus began the longest hour of my life, which concluded with them, like, radioing ahead to clear the runways at O'Hare and let us land first, and they brought an ambulance onto the tarmac, and I thought at the time, like, I'm never going to live this down. This is just a bruised rib, but it wasn't. I was hurt pretty bad, and spent much time in the hospital, and that also kind of changed the way I looked at the world.
Yeah. Yeah, in what way?
Well, I was, like, when I was on the plane, pain like that is unlike, I mean, I've broken bones and had surgeries and had all kinds of things happen to my body and been in a whole bunch of pain, but that kind of pain was really different in that I couldn't figure out what was going on. I also was not unsure that I wasn't going to die, which is about a triple negative, but
yeah,
like,
I was
like, this hurts so much that death would be a pretty decent alternative right now. And coming out of that, I had a new look at life. Like, I think that's part of why I played basketball as long as I did. Like, I was getting close to being burnt out, and then that happened, and I decided to play the way I wanted to play, and that meant kind of letting loose a little bit. I started being more fun to be around, I think, honestly.
Interesting.
And I, you know, that's where I met Scott Wedman, who became kind of my basketball guru, started meditating, got a little new agey, and I think got a lot better as a basketball player because of it. I think that's part of why I said yes when the Suns asked me to write a blog for them, because I didn't care anymore. I was just like, yeah, I'll do that. That sounds fun. That didn't work in my favor for the NBA, but I think when I got overseas after that, I enjoyed being in Europe more. I embraced living life a little better.
That's neat. That's really well said. I mean, reading that, I remember reading that, and I was cringing just reading it. So, goodness gracious.
He was cringing just now when you were just.
I was. I literally was. That's like, not a lie.
I thought he'd be going to lose it for a minute.
I mean, it's like I kind of make fun of it in some cases because it's a little bit of a trope, right? It's a little bit of a stereotype. But when it happens to you, it's very real that, you know, I got out of the hospital and I remember. I was in the hospital for, I don't know, 9 days or something. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting out and being like, holy shit, like the world smells amazing. Now, you can't hold on to that forever. We all need reminders of these things. Mm. And maybe today's conversation is the reminder I needed. but like, there's something to that. Like if you're, and that's part of why I want to write that book, or why I'm working on that book, You're Going to Die. Because I think we live in a time that we're always distracted and moving on to the next thing, and we forget culturally we're going to be dead. And so if you embrace that, it's actually not as scary, because then you live harder, better, faster, like whatever the thing might be that you want. Like if I remind you guys, hey, so you're going to be dead someday, you might behave a little differently tonight. You might tell someone you love them, or work on the project that you care about.
That's well said, too.
There you go. The book is David. The author is Paul Shirley. And this guy has a resume, man. You're putting a life together, my friend.
that's the goal, right? If I drop dead tonight, I'd be like, well, look, I was hoping for more than 45 years, but I had a good run.
There you go.
Well, we wish you many more years.
Because one of my basketball numbers was 45, so that's something I just jinxed.
Well, we wish you many more years, Paul, because we really enjoy reading you, and we enjoy speaking with you. So we really appreciate the time tonight.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for having me. And it's an honor to get to talk about fiction.
Great. So take care and be well. Hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. By the way, your voice sounds like Bill Hicks. Has anybody ever told you that?
Bill Hicks. I don't know who Bill Hicks is.
No, Bill Hicks is a stand-up comedian.
Check it out. You'll see what I mean.
Okay, and here's the other thing. People tell me I look like Walter White, so I got that going
for me. He does look like Walter White. He really does.
All right, we'll investigate some Bill Hicks.
Okay. And the side note to the side note is, a couple years ago, I was covering a Sixers game, and Cranston was at the game, and I've never taken a selfie until then, and I had to go over and take a selfie with Cranston.
It was outstanding.
So,
thanks, Paul.
Thank you so much, Paul. Be well.
Thank you, guys.
Take care. Bye. Paul Shirley. Love that. Love talking with Paul. He's a great guy.
He
would encourage anybody to pick up his books. The first of which is called Can I Keep My Jersey? And it's about him playing in all these different countries and, you know, getting a shot a couple times in the NBA. The second one is called Stories I Tell on Dates, which was kind of amusing, and also revisited a couple of those things. And David, both of us enjoyed. And there's another one out there called Ball Boy, which is, I guess, sort of loosely based on his life growing up in Kansas and such. So he's had a lot of interesting twists and turns to his life. And that story about him being mistaken for Matt Leinart really amuses me, too.
Matt Leinart seems like a good-looking dude. That's probably a compliment.
Yeah, well, Paul is, too. So good for him.
And I think I saw that Bulls team play.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Deb and I were at a conference, one of her conferences, out in Chicago. We were like, let's go to a Bulls game. It was very early in their season. Uh-huh. We paid an unbelievably amount of money to sit in the nosebleeds and watch this awful Bulls team.
Yeah.
It was like Khalid. The starting guards, I think, were Khalid El-Amin and Bryce Drew.
Oof.
And
Marcus Fizer, was he on that team?
Marcus Fizer was on that team.
And that, because he was correct. One of Paul's teammates at Iowa State.
Yeah, he played with some really good players. He did. Remember that point guard? What was his name?
Oh, Jamal Tinsley. Jamal Tinsley.
He was a really good college player.
So, anyway. But, I mean, obviously a guy who really knows about the craft and can really, he tells great stories about his career, but this story about this imaginary rock band, I thought was really well done. And I didn't get a chance to ask him, but I did mean to ask him about the whole thing about creating dialogue, because I think that's a considerable challenge.
Yeah,
and he really, I thought he really crushed it in
some
this
people,
book.
Some people really have that. And I mean, I don't know. I don't think I do.
I don't think I could do that. I don't really think I could.
Well, you'd be surprised what you could do if you spent, if you put the time.
Yeah, maybe that's true.
I do. I think that's really true.
So anyway, but we're grateful to have Paul on, because I really enjoy his work, and I enjoy speaking with him because he is so passionate about what he does. You know what I mean? I love that.
You know, he's very, he's got a broadcaster's voice.
Right.
I'm surprised. Did he ever do TV?
Maybe
he just wasn't interested.
I don't think he did.
I don't know. But you would think he would be a guy that would be almost a natural for one of those ESPN gigs or something like that, like Reddick's doing right now or something like that. Anyway.
Speaking of Reddick, isn't it interesting how quickly he went from the legendary or the next big thing to kind of this guy who's reviled? How quickly did that happen?
You know who would be a great guest for this show? Is whoever the hell is making these calls.
Yes! We got to find that person.
How they rummage through their lineup and decide, we're going to feature this guy for a month, and then he's out, and then he comes back, you know, 8 months later.
Tim Legler.
Tim Legler is knocking it not only out of the park, over the parking lot right now.
Yeah, he's very good.
And he's breaking down of these NBA
playoffs. I think it's like, he's a good example of a guy who's not overexposed, so therefore you appreciate his body work more.
And they clearly are using him the right way in exactly that sense, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
It seems like there's a method to their madness in that case. In other cases, what the hell? It's very strange. And you're right, Reddick had a little bit of an edge to him. You see when he got in that fight with Kendrick Perkins?
I did not.
Yeah, it was in an interview situation. They were talking about the MVP race, and it was a Zoom type thing. And Perkins suggested that people voted for the guy from Denver because he's white. Yeah, that's what he suggested. And Reddick, you know, called him out on it, and Perkins said, no, that's not what I'm saying. Well, that's exactly what you're saying. And in my perception, Reddick went away a little bit for a little while after that, but maybe that could just be my perception. I don't know that that's true, but.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, so it is interesting how the people fade in and out, though.
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't get it.
I mean, I honestly don't get the whole Kendrick Perkins thing. I don't get why, you know, he's suddenly the arbiter of all that is right and good.
Yeah, and he's
about
not.
The NBA.
He has some good moments sometimes, but I think he has some really dumb moments sometimes. And he's just, and now he thinks he's good, so he thinks he's better than he is. So now he's pushing it a little bit,
pushing the envelope. Yeah, I mean, I almost think it's sort of a reaction. Or an attempt at a reaction to how good TNT's show is. And you just can't duplicate. And Barkley in particular, like, he's like, okay, let's get our fat guy on, you know?
Yeah, maybe that's why I didn't think of that. Maybe that is what they're thinking, kind of.
Yeah, although I guess he's supposed to be edgier or something.
Yeah, he's not.
Because nobody's as funny as Charles.
He's not. He's not very, I don't think he's very much like Charles in any way. And I'm not saying he's terrible. He's not terrible, but yeah, that's if that's what they're trying for, which it could be. I think that's a reasonable theory.
Yeah,
they're barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, but it's so difficult to duplicate anything that TNT does with that show, because it's just like four guys sitting around just, you know, cracking on each other, and they have their own little inside jokes, and it just works so perfectly. It's like, I can't imagine. It's just sort of a natural thing, and it kind of grew out. It started with Ernie and Charles and Kenny, and they added Shaq. And I'm not the biggest Shaq guy, but it kind of works.
Yeah, you know? Shaq has something, particularly in the way that he interacts with Charles.
Yeah.
But I could do without Shaq.
Yeah, I honestly think it would be 20% better without
him. I could do without Shaq. Or
if somebody else was in Shaq's chair, like Candace Parker or Jamal Crawford or somebody like that.
And then here's another thing.
Dwayne Wade.
You brought up Candace Parker. That's interesting, because it's interesting to me how they decide that this person
really fits for the big mainstream, like CBS, mm-hmm. doing it, like that's about as mainstream as it gets. That's not really like people like us that they're aimed at. It's interesting to me that they thought that that's was a good spot for her mm-hmm. in the NCAAs to be on, to be in that role, because I think they usually go for like bland generalists in that role. Yeah. But Jay, I think Jay Wright's very good though.
Oh my God, he's amazing.
Yeah, he's really good. So maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But to me, that's what Clark Kellogg is. Mm-hmm. That's what Grant Hill is. Grant Hill is in the position he's in, and I love that guy. You know, what a player! Seems like a great dude. But he's not a broadcaster at all. He's just, it's not there. There's nothing there.
I agree with every part of that statement. I think he's a great human being. He was obviously a great player. His career was cut short by the injury. I mean, well, his all-star portion of his career was cut short by injury. He played a long time. But as a broadcaster, I'm not seeing it. Yeah, I just don't see it.
There's nothing there. And I think because there's nothing there, but he seems like he has a likability, maybe a general human likability.
He does.
That's the guy they put on the NCAAs and CBS. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But Candace Parker would be way better on that show with Kenny and...
I think so.
And Chuck.
Because she has an edge to her, and she would like... She doesn't hesitate to call foul. So she would call those guys out all the time, which is great. That's exactly... But, you know, it is what it is. I guess they just don't want to mess with it. Fine. Now, here's the interesting thing. You mentioned the NCAA. So Nance has retired. So Ian Eagle is taking that role. Do I have that right? Or is that not clear yet?
I don't know. Because Nance is what Brett Musburger used to be. He's what Kurt Gowdy was 100 years ago. And Ian Eagle's not going to be that, I don't think. So. But if you're just talking about the NCAA tournament... He could be. I mean, I don't know if you want somebody to be that anymore. I don't know.
I mean, but at any rate, that crew will undergo change, I would think, because Raftery is obviously way up there. And this is another thing that's interesting. Raftery does a shtick, and I love it. Dick Vitale does a shtick, and I hate it.
Well, Dick Vitale has always sounded to me like a Saturday Night Live sketch parodying an annoying broadcast. I cannot. That is one of the mysteries of the universe to me, that anybody has any reaction to Dick Vitale other than annoyance, because that seems. What else could he be going? Who could behave that way unless they were trying to be annoying?
Yeah.
That's how. And he seems like a great guy.
Yes, that's what my impression as well.
And genuinely loves the game.
Yes,
I don't think. And I don't think he's. I don't think he's a basketball genius, but he's a knowledgeable guy about the game. But his style of broadcasting is so awful.
I know.
I mean, he's one of the very few where I've literally turned the sound off because I can't take it.
Agreed. But Raftery's shtick somehow works. Even I don't know why that
he's
is.
Much different. That's not apples and oranges. That's apples and.
And it's here that I will remind you that when Dana O'Neill was on our show a while ago, she mentioned interviewing Raftery for her book about the Big East and how. Raftery's nieces and nephews refer to him as Uncle One More. Remember that?
Yeah, I do. I also remember Billis taking some shots at him about the drinking on the air.
Always.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure you do know this. Raftery's like 6'7".
Yeah.
He's a big, of course, played in LaSalle.
And I think I remember telling you this, that he wore the same number that Jack Hurd wore. So when I interviewed Raftery for something, he said, and he knew where I was from, he said, well, he hoped that Jack played well enough that they retire his number since they have the same number.
We'll take credit for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Ultimately, Jack did not, but Jack had a creditable career. And speaking of which, he stepped in right after Tim Legler left, and they were hoping he would fill those shoes. And he had a good career, not quite as good as Timmy's.
I forgot that Legler was also. What a shooter, man.
Yeah, he was. Mm-hmm. He was quite the shooter there. Yeah.
And so, he's really good.
Yeah, excellent.
On TV.
Yeah. So, should we talk about the wreckage of the Sixers game 2 against Boston? I mean, they're coming home. They play game 3. It's Thursday night. They play tomorrow night, Friday night at home, and then Sunday afternoon at home. I'm hoping to be at both of those games, so we'll see where the series turns. I mean, the Celtics eliminated the Sixers in 18 and 20. So, I mean, I think they're the better team. Here's the scary part about game 2. The Celtics won by 34 with Jason Tatum shooting 1-for-7.
Yeah.
I mean, because you know that's not going to happen
again.
Well,
I would say this. the rest of them are not going to shoot the way they did last night, too.
Fair.
So that sort of I think more than nullifies that, because they shot. I mean, that was Sixers were down 8-9, 8-12 for quite a while, and then Boston just lost their mind for the three. I could not believe how well they shot for about a good 8 or 9 minute stretch in the game where they just and it went from being a game to being they're up 30 in pretty quick order.
Yeah.
You know, I think 90% of the explanation for last night was it was game two after the home team and the favorite lost game one, and there's no way you can be in the same mental and emotional place, the two teams, in game two. That's most of it, and then the Celtics shot out of their mind, which makes the final score
look. So, yeah, I mean, I think the playoffs, every game is kind of an entity unto itself.
Yeah,
you know, you really, I don't think there really is momentum so much in most series when they have two teams like this. So the Sixers win game one without Embiid, with Harden playing one of his best games he's played for the Sixers. Yeah, scored 45, really made the big shot at the end over Al Horford when they got the switch they wanted. And then he was, you know, Harden was nowhere to be found.
He was not very good last night. And you know, game one, he was phenomenal, but it was a little bit, they were playing a little bit like Houston when they...
Yes.
They were playing a little bit which I don't like, and which I think, I hope they flush this once Embiid comes back, because they can't play like that and win.
Yeah, so...
And I don't want to watch it either, even if they can, so... Yeah. But he was great. Give him credit. And I thought his... Overall, his shot selection was good.
So good, yeah.
He had a phenomenal game, and the Celtics kind of screwed up at the end. And they deserved to win that game. How about they get it? The Celtics have a sideline inbounds, and they go to Smart on a post. They go to Marcus Smart on the post up with the game on the line.
I don't know what that's all about.
And I mean, Brad Stevens is coaching him.
That's ain't happening. No. I mean, you just figure it's going to be the clear out for Tatum and maybe Brown, but not that. I mean, I still think the Celtics at their worst, their rotation is kind of funky. And we've talked about this before, just about what you do with, you know, the Smarts and the Malcolm Brogdons of the world, and how often you play them and when you play them and who you play them with. That's a lot of...
And sometimes it works. Sometimes they play small with two of those three guards in the game, and it works pretty good. Horford is kind of the swing guy. And again, it comes down to, does he make threes? I mean, he didn't make... When he's 1-for-8 from the three, it's a lot big difference. You know?
So, yeah, I'll be curious to see which way this series goes. Because I don't think the Sixers will win both at home. I don't. Which would mean that Boston has the home court advantage again. But, you know, maybe I'll be wrong, too. You know?
I really think a lot of it is going to come down to Embiid's health.
Yeah.
You know, because he's not 100%. He looked very sort of awkward. Sometimes he always looks awkward and sort of labored in his movements.
Yes.
And stuff. He always does. I thought it was a little more last night. And if he's... If he's right, I mean, he's at a place in his career now where it's time. I mean, if you're the best player in the game, he just won the MVP. If you're the best player in the game, you got to put your stamp on this big time. You can't just the normal sort of cruising through the game the way he does.
I agree.
Amazingly effective as it is.
It is odd, because you're right. Even when he's at his best, it doesn't look like he's going 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I just think that there's a mental and emotional element of this where he's got to just put his stamp on it.
I think that's fair. I think that's really fair, because, you know, if not now, when?
Yeah.
You know what?
Yeah, that's right.
Because I think he's 30, and we're right about that point, you know? And we don't know what the
future... Is he 30?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Yeah. So, and, you know, who knows where Harden is a year from now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And they have... And, you know, they have a pretty good group of guys that defend a little bit, guys that can score a little bit. I mean, you know, how much longer is P.J. Tucker going to be what he is? Although he's not an absolutely critical piece. He's a piece, you know.
Yeah, he does some good things, but then he also can be a kind of a cipher, too, offensively. Because he doesn't really take or make shots.
Yeah. How about the other game? No field goal attempts the other night.
Okay. I was wrong. Embiid is 29. He turns 30 next month. No,
you're
so, okay.
You're not off by much, though.
But at any rate.
We get the point.
Yeah. So we also wanted to talk about another basketball story. This is a story you had in today's paper about there was a fight at Spooky Nook during an AAU tournament between a referee and a coach of an AAU team from New York. And just the twists and turns. And Doug Kraft, who we both know well, is a very respected coach and has coached at a lot of levels, including AAU ball. Notably said, well, we shouldn't use this to like impugn the entire AAU thing. Although there's a lot of things that the AAU can be impugned about, I would say.
Yeah, and think of the people who have really ripped the sort of AAU basketball culture. Steve Kerr, Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett. They all have made sort of public statements. I don't know if I completely agree. I see some of that, but I don't know. Anyway. These things that, first of all, we should point out for people who don't know, it's not literally AAU. AAU is the Amateur Athletic Union, and this is, AAU has become an umbrella term for sort of club basketball year-round.
Yeah, well said, yeah.
And that's what we're talking about here, but these events are run by the Hoop Group, and Spooky Nook is, for people who don't know, is this gigantic indoor facility in Lancaster County. It's an amazing place where they can have 30 basketball games going on at one time. So these events, during the NCAA-mandated live period, when coaches can evaluate players in person, there's one in the spring and then there's one in the summer. And the one in the summer, they get, like, Calipari, Patino, the big-time Shire from Duke. They get big-time guys there because there's elite players there getting ready to go to that thing in Georgia that's like the Woodstock of this summer basketball thing. Anyway, so this guy, this coach, this was a coach in a 16 and under, so it wasn't even the older kids. It was a loser's bracket game on one of these remote courts on the back of the facility, and a coach and a ref got into it, and there were punches sort of thrown and a lot of jostling and guys in the boxing stance, and it was an ugly incident. It was one of those incidents where we think this is youth sports and the adults are behaving like infants.
Yes.
Why? It's sort of an easy thing to react that way, and how can you not react that way? And I interviewed last night the woman who took this video of this incident,
which a
lot of people have seen now. It's sort of, I don't know if it went viral, but it got a lot of hits, a lot of movement on the internet. And she said that the first time she saw something like this at one of her son's games, where the coach was getting. Kid on her son's team was on the foul line, and the coach is bitching about the call, and he's getting technical after technical, and the kid's on the foul line just shooting free throws, and she was thinking, what is wrong with these people? It's an understandable and almost unavoidable reaction. What's wrong with these people?
I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but it just. I don't know, maybe it's one of those things that we live in an age where anything goes. I don't know. where there is no shame.
one of the mistakes that I think we make in this culture of constantly being bombarded with instant information is generalizing about, well, that happens, so therefore there's lots of this stuff going on. I mean, there were 400 teams there.
This is kind of what Doug was saying.
There were 400 teams there. I mean, I don't know how pervasive this is. On the other hand, you know, they don't have anything like the vetting process that occurs naturally with a high school basketball coach. He has to get hired. He has to be interviewed. He has to have clearance checks.
That's very true.
Yeah. There's nothing like that for this.
No, it's just some guy.
you know, you pay $750 and you bring a bunch of kids and
you're the coach.
You're the coach. That's right.
There's a great book out there that was written several years ago by George Dorman, who at that point worked for Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, I remember.
And called Play Their Hearts Out. And he followed an AAU team over several years. And it was really incredible because the coach was a guy like that. Kind of. He was just a guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And basically, you know, he passes out sneakers. You know, that's pretty much what he does.
And you know, it's sort of like, it's a little bit like a lot of people have bemoaned in our current culture, the lack of respect for expertise. There are no barriers to, I mean, anybody can write a blog. Anybody can do a podcast.
As we're talking about exhibit A. Here we are.
But there's a downside to that. There's a downside to that, right?
Except in our case, of course.
Yeah, except in our case. But I mean, in terms of, you know, it's kind of cool that somebody who really cares about kids and really loves basketball could just start an AAU team. In a way, that's cool. But how many people want doing that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I don't know what, if anything, can be done, or what, if anything, will be done.
Yeah. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. This team is from New York City, with the coach that was involved in the confrontation, and they tried to contact them. I didn't expect to get a response, and didn't. They have a website, you know, and I tried to contact them. I tried to contact the Hoop group. It was kind of on short notice, but, you know, I've tried to contact them before about things and have not been successful.
Interesting.
So,
I
don't know what to do about that, but it's hard to watch it and not just shake your head and cringe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. So I don't know if we have any answers there, but it was worth noting, and I'm glad it was done, because that was, as you say, it was a video that was out there and had really gotten a lot of traction. And so, anyway, I think we've reached the end of the line here.
Thanks a lot to Paul.
Well, I loved having Paul on, and I hope we have him on again sometime, because he's great talking about hoops or writing or some combination thereof.
That's what we're about. That's what we're about here. He is a distilled product for After the Buzzer.
Yes, indeed.
All right, that's it. We'll be back next week. He's Gordy. I'm Mike. See ya.
See ya later.